The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Welcome to this week's Guardian Books Podcast, in a week when that celebrity techno wizard Stephen Fry is casting his spell over yet another medium.
I've been and gone and done a very stupid thing. I've written a book. As you may know, if you follow these things, it's a book like this. It's rather messy. I came on feeling just like a schoolmaster, you know, with a book with bits hanging out of it, and as if I was about to hand out prep, which is great, because that is what I'm going to do. You will all be writing a little later on. I've written this book. It's about my life, and I propose to read some little extracts from it from time to time to keep us amused and interested, I hope.
Penguin called the launch of the Fry Chronicles groundbreaking, as it involved the magnanimous author appearing simultaneously at London's Festival Hall and at 55 cinemas around the country, broadcast by satellite. My goodness, Stephen, if you're listening, satellite, that's so last century. The e-book comes out at the same time with added video and web links. But he's not the only celebrity in our studio, because we've got Simon Callow here, both to tell us about his own new book, My Life in Pieces, and to give us a sneaky preview of the Fry oeuvre, which he is reviewing for us on the old-fashioned, honest-to-goodness Guardian Review. And alongside him is another Simon Hattonstone, the Guardian interviewer extraordinaire who has dealt with innumerable celebs and their associated scribbles, from Dolly Parton, Paris Hilton, to Bert Trautmann, Rodney Marsh. And of course, here as ever with us is Sarah Crown, editor of the Guardian Books website. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Simon, can we just begin by asking you to introduce and read something for us from My Life in Pieces?
Yes. My Life in Pieces consists of a lot of pieces that I've written for various newspapers, including, needless to say, The Guardian. In fact, a great number of them are from The Guardian, over about 40 years. And it sort of tells my life in art. And almost my first job was in Lincoln at the Theatre Royal, and this is what I wrote about it. Christmas of 1973 to 74. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. On the one hand, it was a freezing winter in the midst of the miners' strike and Edward Heath's three-day week. On the other, I was 24 years old and in hog heaven, theatrically speaking. I was a leading actor at the Theatre Royal Lincoln, only 3 months after leaving drama school, and had already played a major part after major part. Business had been so-so at the theatre, astonishing, really, in the economic circumstances that it held up at all. But now, in December, we were about to embark on the shows which would justify our existence in the town and make it possible for the company to survive for the rest of the year. A Christmas Carol, playing mostly to parties of schoolchildren, and Aladdin, playing to families. A Christmas Carol went with a swing in rehearsal, mingling pity and terror with low comedy. The latter was my particular contribution. I was playing Bob Cratchit and Mr. Fezziwig and countless other larger-than-life characters, and romped through it all with the naked energy and shameless exhibitionism of extreme youth. We shrieked our way through rehearsals. Chris Ryan, later of The Young Ones on television, was playing Scrooge, and we vied with each other in outrageous invention. We soon learned that to catch each other in the eye was fatal, so, of course, we caught each other in the eye as much as possible. Getting on stage and dealing with the set sobered us up a bit. It was a beautiful, complex piece of work, miraculous considering the budget, an affair of lifts and traps and moving scenery, wonderful in action, but it took some negotiating. Snowdrifts were achieved by scattering crumbled polystyrene from the flies overhead. At the dress rehearsal, as I joyously raised my voice to belt out Hark the Herald Angels Sing, I sucked in a mouthful of the stuff, inhaling more up my nostrils, and was suddenly unable to breathe. Young audiences may have been somewhat shocked by the sight of the kindly Bob Cratchit ramming his fingers down his throat and vigorously emitting projectile vomit into the wings, rather in the manner some years later of Linda Blair in The Exorcist. But we had no time for niceties of etiquette. The show must go on, whatever.
Simon, that is absolutely lovely. I think perhaps we should abandon this podcast and make it an audiobook reading. And of course, it is a bit of a reminder that you are one of the most prolific audiobook readers, aren't you?
Yes, so you have been in my time. I once won an award for Male Performer of the Year, which I thought was a bit hard to live up to. It was for reading audiobooks.
Anyway, but that's not what we're going to do, I'm afraid. We're going to talk about your book. And now I have to come out immediately and say this book's a bit of a cheat. because it's actually compiled of pieces you've written before.
Yes, except that at least half of it is new. Because in trying to put together all these pieces in some sort of coherent order, I decided to tell the events as they happened rather than the order in which I wrote them. And so I've written a lot of connective tissue, which in fact tells what was inevitably what was going on in my life. And I found that rather hard to write, actually. I mean, hard in two senses. One, it was quite hard to actually get the narrative clear, but also it involved me digging into some memories that I'd rather sort of put out of my mind. And, you know, it's a story of a person's working life. And whatever we all claim about longing to, you know, stop work and lounge around, actually that probably is the centre for many of us, or a very crucial centre of most of our lives. So it's very unexpectedly personal, I found. I found, in a sense, how much my work matters to me.
Mm. You call it an alternative autobiography.
Yeah.
You mentioned there an anecdote about appearing in pantomime. Tell us a bit about some of the people that you've worked with.
I was incredibly lucky. Very quickly went from my very first job, in which I was on the sort of sprawling on the steps of the Assembly Hall in Edinburgh, crying "I" and "No," and playing the front end of a horse in Büchner's Woyzeck, to being in the West End within 2 years. Harry Secombe had seen me in a play and bought the play, and there we were on stage together, and I literally sort of had my name in lights. And from then on, I kept alternating between doing extreme fringe work and very sort of glamorous West End work, and often coming across some of the great celebrities of my time. So, for example, I did a Carry On Laughing with the whole Carry On crew. It was a television version of it. Sadly, I was cut from it, but I then did get to work with Sid James and Hattie Jakes. I did. My episode was about Queen Elizabeth I, and it was called Orgy and Bess.
But then also the other extreme, you worked with Olivier and Gielgud and everyone like that too.
Well, quite. I mean, my very, very first job in the theatre was working in the box office of the National Theatre when Laurence Olivier was running it, and indeed I'd got the job from writing a letter to Sir Laurence, and he'd said, if you like it so much here, why don't you come and work here? And so I worked in the box office. And then I did get to know the young lions of that time, like Michael Gambon and Derek Jacobi and Anthony Hopkins, who were playing those younger parts, and also people like Sir Laurence and Maggie Smith and Joan Plowright at the top. And then in my own career, I went to work at the National Theatre. I played in Amadeus with Paul Scofield, than whom, in my view, has been no greater actor in the 20th century. I'd grown up on these great actors anyway as a member of the audience. Gielgud, Richardson, Ashcroft, Donald Woolfitt, Michael Redgrave, these were the people we saw all the time, and they made a huge impact on me, and I didn't realise it at the time. I suppose none of us did, but they were in fact the end of a tradition, a particular kind of tradition of what I call thespocentric theatre which revolved absolutely round the actors. And so I have spent quite a lot of my writing life writing about these people to remind people that they existed and to offer them as inspiration. The circumstances which gave rise to these actors have gone. We'll never again have anyone like Laurence Olivier, in my view.
I think it's David Hare called you the great unofficial archivist of the theatre. Now, some of these people are not very nice. I was particularly taken with some of your John Dexter anecdotes. Tell us a little bit about John Dexter.
Well, John was a sort of a thug in art. He was a bully. A terrible bully as a director. He was a very wounded, very damaged man. That was very evident. And because it was so evident, in a sort of a way, one forgave him, unless one happened to be on the receiving end, which I never was, thank God. He was very nice, even sweet to me. But he could be an absolute brute. He picked on people. Famously, he'd have a whipping boy in the company. I remember.
So Peter Shaffer once was a whipping boy during Amadeus when you were working on that, wasn't
it? Well, John didn't direct Amadeus, but when John directed Equus
and
other Peter Shaffer plays, he had nicknames for everybody. He called Peter Shaffer Ruby. I have no idea why, nor did Peter Shaffer know. And eventually, after being taunted about Ruby this and Ruby that, Peter said to him, "Oh, shut up, Rose." And John said, "Rose?" And he said, "Yes, as in Rose, thou art sick."
What about and Arnold Wesker? He was rather rude too. He had a fantastic put down for poor old Arnold, didn't he?
Terrible thing. When he was directing the Kitchen, the famous Wesker play at the Royal Court, Arnold interrupted and suggested something. He said, "Shut up, Wesker, or I'll direct the play the way you wrote it."
Now, anyone who read your first book, Being an Actor, would think you didn't like directors, or indeed listening to this podcast, but that's actually not true, is it? Or this is what you protest?
The purpose of the first book was to point out the existence of what I call directocracy. That's to say that the theatre was increasingly being run for and by directors exclusively. They were the employers, you see, therefore they ran the theatre the way they wanted it to be. And that seemed to be dangerous for actors. Actors were turning up at rehearsals as sort of blank sheets because everything was dictated by the director's concept, taste, whatever. And I was saying to actors, acting is a much bigger art than that. We have to take responsibility. We have to push our point, you know. But people became very terrified. It's changed.
Well, it actually changed partly as in response to your book, didn't it? Or was your book just very lucky in its timing?
I think I articulated a general feeling, and it did so happen that just around that time, things like Ken Branagh's company, Renaissance, was starting, and people were beginning to claim the high ground. And now, actually, we've had, most unexpectedly, a return to the era of the actor-manager. It's not anymore regarded as self-evidently absurd that an actor should run a theatre. The idea fostered by Tony Guthrie that actors were simply not intelligent enough or responsible enough, which was grotesque because that's the whole history of the theatre, is actor managers up to that point.
Which actually brings us to this, to the heart of this book, which is the love affair at the heart of this book, is with the actor.
I suppose so. Yes, I loved acting before I was an actor. It's one of the central arts of pretty well every culture, as far as we can see back in the mists of recorded civilization, that there has always been somebody who stood up in every group and said, look at me, I've got something special to say, and look at what I can do, I can become somebody else. And that's so central. I do believe that the death of the theatre has been predicted routinely, you know, as long as I can remember. But as long as somebody stands up and says that, or needs to stand up and say, look at me, look who I'm becoming, then people will watch.
We put this out to some of our Twitter correspondents who
yes.
asked a few questions to you,
right.
And I will come in immediately with something which follows on from that, which
yes.
is from Imp321, who asks, are there any young actors just starting out who you think have promise?
The great thing is there's great hope for acting, because the talent is enormous. The problem at the moment is that it isn't necessarily given the right outlet. When I was starting as an actor, we had, you know, years in rep. That was the thing that it taught us how to know who we were and to develop. Many young actors just have to plunge straight in at the top, and many of them fall sadly by the wayside.
That's neatly sidestepped. Now, you may have forgotten that we also have another Simon Haddonstone in the studio, and Sarah Hello. Crown, and they've both been filleting the Twitter answers and have their own to put to you.
Ah. OK, we've got Peter Florence here. I don't know if he's the literary Peter Florence, but he's asking you, Simon,
yeah.
since you've spent so much time on Shakespeare's sonnets,
yeah.
how has your relationship changed with them over time?
When I first performed all of Shakespeare's sonnets at the National Theatre in 1979, I didn't really understand the way they worked as verse. I understood, I think, the emotional life, and I understood their literary qualities. I didn't understand the way they worked as music, because they're quite different from the blank verse of the plays. That's the form is just different. A, B, A, B, A, B, A, B, and then C, C, you know. And that's a particular kind of musical form. The other great thing is my sense of Shakespeare, the man, has developed absolutely hand in hand with my relationship with the sonnets. Nobody dares to say this is Shakespeare speaking in his own voice. But the fact is that the emotions recorded in the sonnets are of such intensity, such overwhelming, cauterizing anguish in those poems, more for me than any poems that I know in the English language, I cannot believe that they don't record some kind of personal experience. Therefore, it does bring us somewhat closer to the man, which has been my obsession for the last few years, which has resulted in the play that I'm doing at the moment called The Man from Stratford. It's just to be able to put a face, to put a life to that man, not in the sort of epic detail that we have of Dickens, that's not necessary, just to have a feeling of what sort of a man this stuff came out of. And the sonnets, I think, was absolutely put me on the path for that.
What sort of man did come out of them?
A man who was utterly vulnerable to every emotional impulse that he had. A man who was eyes and ears, who saw and absorbed everything around him, a man absolutely lacking in judgments, a man who was able to use himself as a kind of channel for what he had experienced and absorbed, a man that I think you wouldn't have noticed if he'd been sitting in the same room with you.
Well, thank you very much, Peter Florence, for that question. Sarah, you've got another one.
Yes, the final Twitter question is from somebody called A.E.L. Graves, and he or she asked a bunch of questions, but the one that we were going to ask you was, do you prefer film or stage acting?
Honestly, they're such different phenomena on the one hand, and on the other hand, they're so much the same phenomenon that it's just a delightful change to go from one to the other. But the key difference, clearly, is that in the theatre you have an audience, and the way in which the audience can change me. Movies, on the other hand, enable you to do certain things of extreme intimacy or indeed silence with a reaction shot and so on, or just walking across a square without saying anything at all can be very, very expressive in a way that you can't do in the theatre. But we have to accept that movies actually record something which happened in the past. It cannot change. It doesn't matter how much you laugh at a movie. The actors are never going to change their timing. Whereas in the theatre, it becomes some fantastic, sexy exchange as we build, the audience and the actors, start to build the laughter together, or indeed build the silence together, so as you can create in the theatre most extraordinary focus and intensity and concentration, which you can't plan in the movies, you know?
Well, let us leave this conversation on that sinister note and move on now to Stephen Fry, who is anything but sinister. Simon is going to stay with us and we'll join our conversation a little bit later. Now, as I said earlier, Stephen Fry launched his book at a mega presentation at the Festival Hall on Monday night in London. Here he is reminiscing about his friend and collaborator Hugh Laurie, who he first met working for the Cambridge Footlights Review.
We started writing a sketch there and then, and it was really mysterious. I want to say, really, that we fell in love with each other, but in a collaborative, comedic way. A way that was just simply magical. And it was like love in as much as like in a film cliche where everybody else goes into soft focus and their conversation dims and you only have eyes for each other, except it's about a sketch. Ah, Perkins, come in, sit down, as the sketch begins. And he said, no, maybe it should be, ah, Perkins, sit down, come in. No, that's too silly. No, or whatever. And we just start writing. Fortunately, myself being, and I'm prepared to say it here on the stage, something of a gay sexual, it was a very happy thing that, handsome and charming as Hugh is, I never felt that way about him, because it would have been deeply embarrassing for him and for me and for all of us if that sort of element had been intruded into our otherwise perfect relationship. It was one of the most magnificent enjoyment and pleasure. And, well, I'll just, you know, describe something of our manner, if you like. I'll talk about the love bit. You read about people falling suddenly in love, about romantic thunderbolts that go with clashing cymbals, high quivering strings and resounding chords. And you read about eyes that meet across the room to the thudding twang of Cupid's bow. But it is less often that you read about collaborative love at first sight, about people who instantly discover that they were born to work together or born to be natural and perfect friends. The moment Hugh Laurie and I started to exchange ideas, it was starkly and most wonderfully clear that we shared absolutely the same sense of what was funny and the same scruples, tastes, and sensitivities as to what we found derivative, cheap, obvious, or stylistically unacceptable. Which is not to say that we were similar. If the world is full of plugs looking for sockets and sockets looking for plugs, as roughly speaking the Platonic allegory of love suggests, then there is no doubt we did seem each to possess precisely the qualities and deficiencies the other most lacked. Hugh had music, where I had none. He had an ability to be likably daft and clownish. He moved, tumbled, and leapt like an athlete. He had authority, presence, and dignity. I had... Oh, hang on, what did I have? Well, patter and fluency, I suppose, verbal dexterity, learning. Hugh always said that I also added what he called gravitas to the proceedings. Although he had great authority himself on stage, I suppose I had the edge on playing older authority figures. I wrote, too. I mean, I actually physically wrote lines down with pen and paper or typewriter. Hugh kept the phrases and shapes of the monologues and songs he was working on in his head and only wrote them down or dictated them when a script was needed for stage management or administrative purposes. Hugh was determined that the Footlights should look grown up but never pleased with itself, or, God forbid, cool. We both shared a horror of cool, to wear sunglasses when it wasn't sunny, to look pained and troubled and emotionally raw, to pull that sneery, snorty, what? Face at things that you didn't understand or from which you thought it stylish to distance yourself. Any such arid, self-regarding, stylistic narcissism we detested. Better to look a naive simpleton than jaded, tired or world-weary, we felt. We're students, for fuck's sake, was our credo.
Stephen Fry. Gravitas, yes. Simon. Now tell us, what did you think of this book? Does it have gravitas?
Well, I have to confess that I've only just got it and I'm not even up to that point. But Stephen does have gravitas, but it's of a very peculiar kind. It's a sort of gravitas in inverted commas. Self-satirical gravitas.
So, Sarah, we've seen extracts in a Sunday paper which shall remain nameless, and you won't be able to find it on the website because it isn't there. it's quite interesting, the stuff that's got in it, isn't it?
Yes, there was one of the things that I sort of particularly noticed was that there's a lot about body image and food in the book from what we could gather from this extract. And I wondered whether, Simon, you thought this was something that affects actors.
It does now. Just the way it affects all men more than it ever did affect men before. I'm talking, obviously, for women. But body image has always been critical on stage. I mean, it's been all about that. As far as I know, Laurence Olivier was the first British actor ever to go to a gymnasium. On the continent of Europe, especially in Eastern Europe, a middle-aged actor is expected to have a kind of massive chest and a solid diaphragm and to be a man of some weight.
Substance.
You know. Substance, gravitas, indeed. But in England, more and more, everybody's trying to look like Brad Pitt, you know. I mean, the ideal for an actor is to be versatile physically, so as you can be all things. That's what we all sort of aim for, should aim for.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is probably going to be one of the big... either of the books might be the big Christmas seller. But I think in view of your total ignorance of technology and Stephen Fry's nearly 2 million Twitter followers, probably...
Come on, Callow!
It's Stephen who may well end up being the big seller. And, of course, it is, you know, we'll be on the celebrity shelves, and we're still very much in the age of celebrity, aren't we, Sarah? We've got Katie Price up in the top 10 again. That's a.k.a. Jordan. Although there has been a bit of a blip this week, hasn't there? Which is...
Yes. Yes, Emma Donoghue's book Room has come in ahead of Katie Price's novel Paradise in this week's chart. It's interesting that it's Donoghue's book out of all of the Booker shortlisted novels that have sort of pipped Jordan to the top of the bestseller charts. And I thought maybe it was to do with the fact that, as with autobiographies, they're an easy book to buy for yourself or for someone else because you kind of feel like you know what you're going to get. You have a sense of what the book's going to be before you open it. And with Room and Emma Donoghue's book, what everyone knows about it, because it's been in the paper so much, is that it's based on a real-life event, Joseph Fritzl's case in Austria. And so I think that even though, you know, you might think that would put people off reading it, it is still something that you can hook onto and a way of understanding what the book's going to be about. So I thought maybe that could be the reason for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, we always go on about how celebrity is a modern thing, but it isn't, is it, Simon? Dickens, your hero, one of your
heroes.
Was
the greatest, absolutely the most famous man in the world. But the word celebrity, used in the sense in which we're using it, came in 1815. And it was coined for Byron.
Ah, Byron, yes. And, of course, there was a prurient interest in Byron and his sex life.
Totally, absolutely, which of course, wasn't the case with Dickens at all. Dickens was a celebrity because he was a hero of the people and because his books were so instantly accessible to their audience. At least the early ones were absolutely became part of their landscape, you know. So that when he did his readings, and they just, rather like Frank Sinatra and I Did It My Way, Dickens just had to say, Mrs. Gamp just had to say, Gamps! And they roars of laughter and cheers. But he, of course, came, as all celebrities do, to rather dread it, because they just wouldn't leave him, especially in America. They would not leave him alone.
So there was a cult of him as well as the characters he was playing.
Totally.
And he did, there is some suggestion that actually it's what killed him at the age of 58.
Well, not celebrity itself, no. I think actually doing the readings is what did it, because he did them with such intensity and such passion. But he worn himself out, you know, like Shakespeare, like Mozart. These people, you function at that level of creative intensity all the time, just pouring this stuff out, kills you.
But the point about Dickens is that he actually did write the things, isn't it? Whereas some celebrities today, we hear rather scurrilous tales of them not actually having any contact with their products at all. Simon, you've interviewed Katie Price, who, since we mentioned a minute ago her novel, we should perhaps bring up here.
Yeah, Katie kind of tends to brand her novels rather than write them. I mean, she did explain that very coherently that what she does is she goes away and thinks of an idea. So it's almost like being a commissioning editor, really. So she would say, for example, I'd like a love story that involves a pony and quite a bit of sex, and please could you bring it back to me? And then she signs it. And then it's her book. It's part of brand price. In the celebrity world, it would almost be more scurrilous now to write your own autobiography. I'd be like, what? Or even to read it. To read it, that would be shocking. I remember the first time I interviewed someone and he seemed really surprised at the suggestion that he might have read it.
We're talking about two different sorts of celebrity. We're not impugning you, Simon.
Absolutely not.
There is a horrible side to this, isn't there, which we need to move on to now, I think, which is that...
I brought you in for the horrible bit.
Which is that there tends to have to be some sort of unseemly revelation, doesn't it? Now, again, this is not true of Simon or Stephen sort of book.
It's a weird thing. It's either revelation or lack of revelation, but either way, it tends to be lack of truth. For example, if you look at the footballers' autobiographies that came out to herald our brilliant, successful campaign in 2006, they didn't talk about the one thing that people on the whole were interested in, which was their, you know, inconsistency, their fickleness, their sexual shenanigans. So they kind of have a lack of truth, whereas I think there is an element of celebrity biography or autobiography, where you have to hype up crises in your life, etc., etc. I think the Blair book is a classic example. I was away when it came out, and there were these headlines in Portugal saying, Blair has huge drink problem, confession. And what Tony actually said was, I think I was getting a drink problem. I had two glasses of wine a night. And unfortunately, what happens is that the media go along with it because it's in our interest too. So we might know that really it's kind of bullshit that if Tony Blair does drink two glasses of wine a night and possibly even a single whiskey, he's not got a huge drink problem. But of course, it makes a good headline for us. So it becomes a vicious circle.
Mm. You make a distinction between this thing from Tony Blair and Sheila Hancock's outing of her husband John Thor as an alcoholic. Then.
I think that was totally the opposite. I love Sheila. Not that I don't love you, Tony. But Sheila felt she had to out John Thor because she knew that there was a journalist who hadn't known John or hadn't known him well who wanted to write a book about his alcoholism, which had never been discussed. And amazingly, John had managed to work through his life and concealed it, but not concealed it from Sheila, of course. And so she wrote the most loving, humane, honest book about her relationship, hugely selling because I think lots of people related to it.
Yeah, that's the two of us.
Yeah. Because they saw it as a relationship that even if people weren't living with someone with a drink problem, I think people could relate to it, just the tone of it and the intensity of the relationship, yeah, etc.
So now we've talked about self-outing, as it were. What about being outed by biographers? We have a review in this week's Saturday Review, Sarah, which is of a new book about Shirley Bassey. And our reviewer, John O'Connell, is very sniffy about some of the facts that it comes up with.
Yes, I was wondering if it'd be all right to read some of it, actually, because it sort of needs to be spoken or heard, I suppose. Why should she be dunked in this mud bath? There are two answers, neither terribly satisfactory. One is that her father's offence, while never revealed by the media, has for years been an open secret in the area around Cardiff's Tiger Bay, where Bassey grew up, and then in brackets, doorstepped by John Williams, the author of the book. Old acquaintances of the family asked hesitantly, you know about her father. Also, all the relevant documents were in the public domain, so journalists' silence on the subject becomes, for Williams, not a laudable moral reflex, but a sin of omission. The other, not a bad answer but pretty specious, is that full knowledge of the harshness of Bassey's impoverished childhood can only enhance our admiration for her achievement.
Now, we haven't actually said what this was, this thing that was outed. It's that her Nigerian father was allegedly deported for raping a child in Cardiff. Now, of course, you're talking the early part of the 20th century. It's a very long time ago. Do you buy John O'Connell's line?
I think that's a fantastically pompous justification for his outing. It's ridiculous. I mean, how would that in any way reflect on Shirley Bassey? I don't think there's a right or wrong on asking about it, but to say that we had a moral duty to quiz her on, you know, her father's alleged rape is just rubbish, isn't it?
I don't know. I think I probably agree with Simon. It's an odd way of justifying it, I think.
And also the idea that you're actually showing up the trials of her childhood.
Yes, it's just
spurious as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's also
not to say it's not interesting or relevant. It's just the way he writes about it. Mm. I mean, I also think biographers have a huge difficulty now in that, on the whole, people aren't interested in reading biography. We always want to read autobiography, even if we know it's not written by that person. It will hopefully have come from tapes, from conversation, and it's the immediacy, I think, to the famous person, it's the immediacy to their words. So I think the biographer has to hype up
the personal aspect of it.
The personal aspect, the discovery. And, you know, if you look at someone like Kitty Kelly, I don't know, A, if Kitty Kelly would sell as much as she would years ago, because whoever she's doing, I mean, people would rather read about opera from opera than opera from Kitty Kelly. But again, it has to be sensational to have any impact, to make the news and to sell.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've got a load of autobiographies, memoirs, biographies coming up for Christmas. Are we expecting any salacious details to come out of them? Simon, I know you've interviewed Michael McIntyre, the comedian, whose Life and Laughter is one of them. What came out of that?
I couldn't see the autobiography, but I think it sounds quite interesting to me what he's done, because I like the autobiographies. I think we're wrong to diss them all. And he's written his own. And from speaking to him, what he said is it enabled him to discover and analyse his relationship with his dad, who had been a comic who died early on. And he was never quite sure how that had influenced him as a comic and whether it had made him want to follow in his footsteps and made him shy away from it.
Sarah, that brings us to Alexei Sayles, another.
Yes.
This is an intriguing one, another comedian with his is called Stalin Ate My Homework.
Yeah, this is an interesting one for me because, as it happens, my dad went to school with Alexei Sayles and was sort of friends with him at school. And Alexei Sayles emailed him to ask him for his memories of their shared school days. But apparently, when he was at school, his whole household was very, very left-wing Marxists. And this is sort of his account of growing up in a Marxist household, basically. But then we've also got Stuart Lee, another comedian, How I Escaped My Certain Fate, which is being reviewed in the Guardian Review this week. And Michael Caine, The Elephant to Hollywood, which sounds like a big one to me.
Which it might be. I think that's going to be a comfy cardy sort of autobiography. I suspect it'll be for all those people who really loved him 30 years ago.
We've also got Ryan Giggs on how he really wanted to be a Manchester City player all along.
And what is interesting to me is the fact that these people do their day job and then they go and out themselves by night, which actually brings us back to Dickens and what you, Simon Callow, describe as his carnal need to communicate with his readers.
Like a lover, he responded instantly to their moods and to their wants. They, for their part, expected him to speak for them, to express their joys and their miseries, to create for them their monsters and their comic heroes.
So perhaps it wasn't really so different after all. And that's it for this week's podcast. But don't go just yet. We have two signed copies of Simon Callow's book, My Life in Pieces, to give away to people who can follow our multimedia treasure trail. Go to the front page of this podcast on guardian.co.uk/books to find the questions which will lead you a merry dance through our archives and into Saturday's Guardian Review. The first two correct entries will get the books. Meanwhile, thanks to Simon Callow and Hattonstone and to Sarah Crown. I'm Claire Armistead and our producer is Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.